This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Asma Mir. Before you listen to your podcast, I'd like to remind you about the Radio 4 Christmas Appeal, which may be as familiar to you as carols and Christmas crackers. Over its long history, Radio 4 listeners have supported St Martin in the Fields to provide practical help and support to thousands of people so that they can leave homelessness behind. Many people, for many reasons, find themselves a long way from home. Their journey home can start anytime and anywhere. It can start with a cup of tea and someone listening. It can start with a deposit for a room in a house. Please support the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal with St Martin in the Fields by donating online on the Radio 4 website. Whether you're a long-standing donor or this is your first year, thank you. Home starts here.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello. In 1919, huge audiences saw an American film report on the recent war with the Ottoman Empire on the Middle Eastern Front and were thrilled by its star, a British officer in Arab clothes. This was T.E. Lawrence, soon known as Lawrence of Arabia, and he became famous, a boy's own figure, an exotic image of the British as they might want to see themselves, adventuring in the Orient, far from the brutal horrors of the Western Front. We're discussing him today, as this autumn we asked you to suggest a topic for this, our Listener Week, and he made the shortlist from over 1,000 ideas. Our thanks to Zachary Veith, June L.K., Keith Hopcraft and Anthony Killeen for proposing this, and to you all. With me to discuss Lawrence of Arabia are Hussein Omar, lecturer in modern global history at University College Dublin, Katrina Pennell, Associate Professor of Modern History and Memory Studies at the University of Exeter, and Neil Faulkner, a Director of Military History Live and editor of the magazine Military History Matters. Neil Faulkner, what made T.E. Lawrence stand out as a boy?
Well, I don't know that he necessarily stood out particularly from his contemporaries. I think he stands out for us when we look back at the biography, because there was a strange family situation, which I think was crucial to understanding the role that he comes to play, and indeed the kind of biography that he has. Although he was brought up in a respectable upper middle class family in North Oxford, there was a family secret, which was that his father and his mother were not married, and so the five boys were illegitimate. And this, of course, is in the context of an English upper middle class before the First World War, which is very snobbish and very judgmental. So this was something that needed to be kept secret. And I think that he lived in fear of exposure. I think he also had a very difficult sexuality, which he was becoming aware of course, presumably when he was a teenager. And that leads to, I think, a retreat from that difficult reality, those difficult family circumstances, into a kind of romantic, medieval fantasy world. He becomes obsessed with the Middle Ages, obsessed with Arthurian heroes and Crusader knights. That becomes his subject at university. He becomes a romantic in the kind of William Morris, pre-Raphaelite kind of sense. And I think that that is an escape from this quite difficult family situation that he's in.
He went to Oxford. He studied archaeology. Was he good at it?
I think he probably
went to Oxford University. He lived in Oxford, but he went to university, yes.
Yes, he did. He lived in Oxford and he went to university there and became an archaeologist. He was trained in medieval history but becomes an archaeologist and then gets shoehorned into his first job after graduation by his academic mentors, which is to work as what we would nowadays call a deputy director on a big excavation in the Middle East. And that's because he's already got Middle Eastern experience, because his undergraduate dissertation had taken him to the Middle East, where he did his dissertation on Crusader castles. And he'd done primary research there in the Middle East. Was he good? I think probably by the standards of the time, because they did things in a certain way in that period, and he was probably as good as anybody else at that time. And his main job, interestingly, and crucially really for the role that he subsequently plays, was managing the Arab workforce, because that's how excavations were done in those days. You had a local workforce. He managed the Arab workforce, and that meant that by the time of the First World War, he was pretty well fluent in Arabic and very, very knowledgeable about the Middle East.
Did he take to the Arabic community the first time he went there? He seems to have been passionate about it. Was it a sudden falling for it, or did it grow?
I think it arises out of his romanticism. I think this escape into a kind of Middle Ages that, of course, never really existed. I mean, it's an imagined Middle Ages.
The Crusaders, bold, noble,
flawless, kind of,
exactly, winning.
Exactly, all of that kind of thing. And I think he almost sees a kind of reincarnation of people like that, particularly in the Bedouin of the desert. And
why particularly the Bedouin?
I think because, if we're going to see it through his eyes, if we're going to use his terms, I mean, he talks about the desert being clean and the people of the desert being uncontaminated, uncorrupted. He uses those kinds of words, which, of course, is an Orientalist, as we would see it now, an Orientalist perspective on the people of the Middle East, but in particular on the people of the Middle East who are seen to be least affected by modernity, which in a sense he's trying to escape from.
Thank you very much. Katrina, what was the state of the Ottoman Empire? That's a big player in this story. Enormous empire, hundreds of years. Let's get there in the middle of the First World War.
Okay, so I would describe the Ottoman Empire on the eve of the First World War as vulnerable, but I think we have to be careful to avoid describing it in some sort of form of inevitable decline. Certainly the term sick man of Europe had been used from the mid-19th century onwards, but I think it's worth bearing in mind that this was a term that came from the great European powers themselves, and it served a particular agenda of the great European powers. As you say, this was a massive empire. It existed for the best part of 600 years. It had a huge territorial expanse at its height. It had got far into Central Europe as Vienna. It had around 30 million subjects from many different faiths and ethnicities. The traditional historiography goes that by the late 1600s, the Ottoman Empire is in decline. But more recent scholarship highlights that actually what it was going through was a series of crises that led to reform and adaptation. By the 18th and 19th centuries, the Ottoman Empire had suffered a series of very serious military defeats, and it was very aware that militarily it was lagging behind some of the other major European powers, the Habsburg Empire and the Russian Empire in particular. And this triggered perhaps one of the most important series of reform periods for the empire, the Tanzimat reforms, which led to a very powerful centralised and organised state entity coming out of Constantinople, now known as Istanbul. But so I would say on the eve of the First World War, the society and the economy was in some ways quite vibrant. There was certainly more civic engagement, political participation. But this was all overshadowed by a very strong sense of threat. both from within the empire itself, from minority groups, particularly in the provinces, who were becoming frustrated with rule from Constantinople and were thinking about ways that they could subvert imperial power.
Which minority groups in particular?
Well, I'm thinking in particular of those in the Arab Peninsula, the families obviously of Sharif Hussein, but also Ibn Saud and the al-Rashid family. But there was also significant external threat, and that's from the great European powers themselves, who are thinking about how they can maximise Ottoman weakness to their own advantage.
And that includes the Suez Canal, it includes...
For the British, the Suez Canal was absolutely crucial. I mean, half of British shipping to India was going through the Suez Canal by the eve of the First World War. And of course, the Suez Canal is strategically very important for India, which is Britain's jewel in the imperial crown. But the other European powers are very interested in what's going on. So it's interesting to see how the Ottoman Empire ends up siding with Germany at the outbreak of the First World War, because Germany is probably one of the only European great powers that hasn't really tried to annex anything.
Well, thank you very much. Hossein Omar, can we talk about the Arab influences here? Now, when we talk about Arabs, we're talking about many different tribes and so on, so we have to be careful. Let's start with Sharif Hussein. Who was he? What did he want? Why is he important?
So in 1916, at the time of the Arab Revolt, Sharif Hussein is a 63-year-old man. Sharif is not his name, it's his title. It's the title given to the descendants of the Prophet in the Ottoman Empire. He is, from 1909 onward, the custodian of the holy sites of Mecca and Medina, the crucial pilgrimage sites where one of the five pillars of Islam are performed every year in the Hajj. And so therefore, he has a hugely important role and is second only to the caliph, i.e. the sultan, in religious authority within the empire. Now, what does Sharif Hussein want? That's an interesting question. We have evidence that Sharif Hussein, before the First World War, might have wanted to establish a sort of semi-autonomous dynasty within the empire on the model that, for example, Mehmed Ali of Egypt had done about 100 years earlier. But from 1908 onwards, there's a revolution within the Ottoman Empire, a constitutional revolution. There's a huge amount of enthusiasm for it among many of the populations of the Ottoman Empire. But it brings into power what the group called the Committee of Union and Progress, who eventually deposed the Sultan in 1909. And they begin to centralize the empire, thereby going into Sharif Hussein's territories.
Now, can we talk about the Arab Revolt? And well, I'd like Lawrence to come in again, because the Arab Revolt, when does he start having an influence? He's there, he's joined up at the beginning of the First World War, been smartly sent to the Middle East because of his knowledge, becomes an intelligence officer, and then gets particularly interested in certain sections of the Arab world.
Sharif Hussein is sending off his two sons to Damascus on the one hand and to Cairo to try and see what support there might be for a revolt against the empire. What sort of prompts this is the centralizing attempts of the Young Turks to extend the Hejaz Railway into his territories. But also he gets there's a rumor that he might be deposed, if not assassinated. And so he sends his two sons, Faisal and Abdullah. Abdullah goes to Cairo to sound out the British officials in Cairo over whether they might potentially support his revolt. And his son Faisal goes to Damascus to talk to some of the secret societies that had sprung up.
So the revolt is starting in 1916. Lawrence is there as an intelligent agent. We know he's very sympathetic, understanding of certain parts of the Arab culture and the Arab world. Let's start him in action. What does he do? Why is he sent to where he's sent and by whom?
Well, he's sent there because he is an Arabist by the time. Sent to Cairo, initially to Cairo, because he's an Arabist and they need specialists in the Middle East. Obviously, once the Ottoman Empire comes into the war on the same side as Imperial Germany, and there's a threat to the Suez Canal, which we referred to earlier. But Lawrence, for 2 years, he's an intelligence officer in Cairo. He's doing a desk job. The revolt breaks out in June 1916. and Lawrence is not involved until October 1916, when he goes for the first time to Arabia. So he sets foot in Arabia literally for the first time in October 1916. And it's a fact-finding mission, really, because the revolt is hanging by a thread at that moment in time. And what the British want to know, really, is what ought we to do to bolster this revolt, which they see as being quite useful because it ties down Ottoman military strength. And it's on that occasion that Lawrence meets the field commanders. I don't think he meets Hussein on that occasion, but he meets the field commanders who are Hussein's sons, particularly Faisal and Abdullah, as Hussein has referred to them. He's impressed by Faisal and reports back to his superiors that Faisal is a man who's worth investing in. And then he goes back on a second occasion, December 1916, and it's on that second occasion that a strong relationship forms between Faisal and Lawrence, and Faisal requests of the British that they attach Lawrence to him permanently as a liaison officer.
That's rather unusual. How did he get it through?
I think they're very, very keen to curry favour with the Hashemite leadership of the revolt. So they've no particular reason to hold on to this junior intelligence officer. If one of the Arab field commanders wants him as a liaison officer, why not? That's quite useful.
And what does Lawrence think he's doing by being attached to Faisal? What does he see his function is?
Well, this, of course, is hugely controversial.
Great.
And yeah, I know. People argue, argue endlessly about Lawrence's motivation and Lawrence's role. And I think we have to distinguish the two things, really. I think, it's not, you can caricature Lawrence as a kind of agent of British imperialism. And of course, the British are using him for their own purposes. But of course, he's not really on message. And he's not on message, I think, because he's not a regular officer. He's not a conventional member of the upper middle class. He's a romantic. He's got this orientalist view of the Arabs. I think it's true to say that Lawrence is genuinely at some level rooting for the Arabs. I would describe him as a liberal imperialist who imagines that in the framework provided by the British Empire and the Arab revolt, some kind of Arab state might emerge at the end of the First World War. I think he's in it for that. He wants to help create a new nation state, really.
Going along with that, Katrina, can I ask you, what would have been a good outcome for Sharif Hussein if the revolt had gone as he'd hoped?
Well, I think essentially he had put a lot of store by the Hussein McMahon correspondence, which was a set of letters that started in July 1915 between himself and Sir Henry McMahon, who was the British High Commissioner in Cairo at the time. Hussein had tried to get the attention of the British before the First World War, but it wasn't really until, I would say, Gallipoli, the landings at Gallipoli had were appearing to be, quite disastrous, that the British then began to take seriously the idea of a Muslim ally who could act as some kind of counterweight to the Sultan Caliph, as Hussein has outlined. And so in this series of letters, it's about 10 letters, it goes back and forth in quite ambiguous terms about what it is that Hussein wants in return for the revolt. And effectively what Hussein wants is some kind of independent Arab kingdom. The precise geographical boundaries of that territory are not defined, and there are a number of moments in the correspondence when McMahon says, that's going to have to wait until after the war is over, and Hussein is accepting of that. And I think by the end of the correspondence he's very aware that he's asking for more than he's necessarily going to get, but at the root of it he understands that in return for mounting this revolt and in return for putting his allegiances with the British, they are going to get some kind of territory in return.
So it's very important for this programme. He thought that the British, that he was helping the British, and they would give him a great deal of what he wanted, what he wanted in the end was to be the King of Arabia, but they would give him a great deal of that. Do you find that, Hussein Omar, do you find that a plausible supposition on his part?
Absolutely. I mean, what happens is he's unsure what kind of kingdom he wants to begin with. So is it going to be limited to the Hejaz, i.e. the province of northwest Arabia that his family has held this office in for a very long time? But when his son Faisal makes contact with the secret societies in Damascus, they draw up what's called the Damascus Protocol, which provides a kind of blueprint for a much more ambitious version of what that Arab kingdom might look like. The assurances that he gets suggest that he will get the kingdom after the end of the war.
And Lawrence holds that in his heart. I mean, this matters to Lawrence. This is something that he thinks he's fighting for. Is that right?
I think that's probably right. I think that's right.
And that governs a great deal of what he does, not only for the rest of the war, but sort of for the rest of his life in one way or another.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Neil Faulkner. So he enters into this revolt, this British intelligence officer, a fairly low rank, as you said earlier on, but he's taken in by the brother Faisal, the cleverest brother, he thinks, and they have a friendship. What does he do when the revolt starts?
Well, I think initially he is indeed a liaison officer and an advisor in the background, and his role throughout is to be a kind of conduit funneling gold, guns, munitions, supplies and so on to the Arab revolt. He always has that role right up until the end. But it seems pretty clear to me that what is happening increasingly is that he is becoming actively a combatant, that he is involved in many of the guerrilla operations, some of which I think he's actually planning. And I think he has a loud voice in the inner councils of the Hashemite Arab leadership of the revolt when decisions are being taken about how to conduct it.
Given that he was a junior officer, as you say, and given that he was thought to be working for the British, how did he have such a loud voice in those inner councils?
I think because he's won a close personal relationship. He secured a close personal relationship with Faisal. And I think because, you know, the Bedouin culture is very much, it's not particularly concerned necessarily with British military rank. It's concerned with whether or not there is what is considered to be an effective personal relationship established. But I think probably also part of that in relation to Lawrence and Faisal is that Lawrence was genuinely on the Arab side as he understood it in his kind of liberal imperialist orientalist way. He is rooting for the Arabs. And I think that means there's a trust which perhaps wouldn't have existed with other officers.
Katrina Pennell, what were the British objectives in this part of the world? And was there a sense in which he was obstructing them in any way?
Well, I think it's helpful to think about sort of long-term and short-term objectives. And we've already mentioned the Suez Canal, and that is absolutely pertinent to the British, that they have to protect that shipping route, that they have to make sure that no one else gets their hands on that shipping route because of its importance to India. The British weren't satisfied just occupying an entire subcontinent. They wanted to dominate the entire route between Britain and that subcontinent. And it became something of an obsession, really, for the British to make sure that they maintain that control. So there were a number of coaling stations that the British set up in Gibraltar, Malta, Cyprus. But they also set up sort of treaties of mutual convenience with dynasties that occupied parts of Oman and Aden and Bahrain. With the outbreak of the war, the short-term objective was win the war. I mean, you know, it's as simple as that. But there were a number of sort of sub-objectives within that. First of all, making sure that the British Navy had access to oil. In the years leading up to the outbreak of the First World War, the British Navy had been increasingly moving from coal to oil, and the British wanted to make sure that they protected the Anglo-Persian oil pipeline. So that's one of the reasons why, on the 6th of November 1914, a British and Indian Expeditionary Forces landed in southern Iraq in Basra, and then the mission sort of takes on a sort of life of its own and moves up the territory.
Was there any sense in which the British objectives were hindered by what Lawrence was doing in the Arab revolt?
Certainly the British government, by the time of the revolt in 1916, having experienced significant disasters in their campaign in that part of the world, and I'm thinking of not only the amphibious landings at Gallipoli that had ended in effectively a defeat and a retreat in early 1916, but also the siege of Kut Alamara in the spring of 1916. The British, I think, were very inclined to winning the war effort in the Ottoman Empire through local means, that they had realised that an invading foreign army wasn't necessarily going to get them the objectives that they wanted. So in that sense, yes, I think it did tally, absolutely.
One of the things we are told that he did was to help instigate or develop a guerrilla warfare. Is there any truth in that?
Well, I think that is true.
And how did that operate?
Well, I think what he's doing is he's taking the way of war which is already established in the desert, which is not very, very different indeed from the kind of warfare that's being fought conventionally in the trenches in Europe. It's much more about ambush and hit and run and raiding and that kind of thing. And he's inflating that into a guerrilla insurgency, or certainly he's in reinforcing those voices in the Arab high command who take the view that what we need to do is to mount a guerrilla war, first and foremost against the railway line, the Hejaz railway, which runs from Damascus down to Medina, and which is the key Ottoman-Turkish supply line east of the River Jordan. They've got a garrison of 10,000 men at Medina, and a series of pinprick attacks coming unexpectedly, hitting different places at different times, mean that huge numbers of Ottoman soldiers end up getting tied down trying to defend 800 miles of railway line from Damascus to Medina.
Thank you very much. Hussein, what did the Arabs engaging in this revolt, what did they set out to do?
There are multiple objectives. There's the kind of dynastic ambition of the Hashemites, but they're joined by Arabs from other places, from Egypt, from Syria, who are simply concerned with trying to overthrow the Ottomans. And there's a huge debate as to why that develops as a feeling, because in 1913, in the first Arab Congress in Paris, most Arabs who were participants in this conference did not express any separatist sentiment. But by 1915, 1916, there seems to be a growing discontent across the Arab world in very different sorts of places. And those very different participants, the revolt sort of brings them all together.
Was Lawrence known to be very supportive of this?
I think he was. It's interesting. I mean, if you think about the story from the Arab side, Lawrence doesn't loom as largely as he does in our own imaginaries, and that's quite interesting because Lawrence is certainly part of the story. It's not like people are trying to write him out, but he doesn't seem to have the kind of totemic significance that he does in the version of the story as it's told in Anglo-American writing.
Neil Faulkner, what can you put your finger on and say Lawrence made a difference here that was important?
Well, there are probably different ways in which one could answer that. But I think one thing that is worth saying in response to that is what happens in relation to Aqaba. Because
Aqaba being?
Well, Aqaba is the forwardmost base which can be supplied by sea, that is by the British, who have naval supremacy, where you could potentially base an Arab force in order to carry operations forwards into, up to as far as Damascus. Mm-hmm. Now, it's quite clear that the British didn't particularly want the Arabs to take Aqaba. In particular, the French didn't want the Arabs to take Aqaba because they had their designs very much on Syria and Lebanon. The idea was that the Arabs were to be bottled up, really, in Arabia, where they could tie down Ottoman soldiers, but they wouldn't become players in the post-war struggle for power. I think Lawrence goes off message in a very serious way in May.
Literally, actually.
Well, he goes absolutely literally off message in the sense that nobody can communicate with him and nobody knows where he's gone and what he's actually
done. For a considerable period,
for 2 months. He sets off in May 1917. He's the only Brit with a group of about 50 Arab fighters. They go on a 600-mile march through the desert to raise the desert tribes and then to descend into what is nowadays southern Jordan, and to take Aqaba. Aqaba today is a port in southern Jordan. By taking Aqaba as an Arab force, what they've done is they've created a situation where the Arabs can now begin to project military power towards Damascus. Now, that is immediately calling into question the secret arrangements which have already been made by the British and the French to carve up the Middle East in their interests. Lawrence has gone completely, as I say, off message in doing this.
So what's he doing off
message? And disrupted the plans. Well, he's disrupted the plans because he knows what the plans are, and he's rooting for the Arabs. He wants the Arabs to be players in the post-war settlement of the Middle East. He tries to put the Arabs into a position where they might be able to challenge the secret Sykes-Picot agreement.
Anglo-French.
Yes, which is the Anglo-French and agreement. Russian originally, yes, indeed.
Katrina, those in Britain who are trying to keep up with these affairs in bewilderment about the Middle East, and what messages were they getting back about what was happening there?
The concentration really was on the fighting in the Western Front for the most part. And really, it wasn't until 1917 that the British government realised that they needed to be explaining better to their populations at home what was going on in the Ottoman Empire and why that fight was taking place. So you see quite a concerted propaganda effort appearing in 1917 through 1918, where the British are explaining the fighting in the Near East in terms of Britain being the kind of promoter of nationality, that they are trying to free the embryonic nations within the Ottoman Empire from the chains of imperial rule. I mean, that message, it's hard to tell how far it percolated, and certainly the British Home Front tended to view the fighting in the Ottoman Empire in a very, as Neil describes, orientalist way, in terms of this kind of romantic, chivalrous, mysteriously charming effort that contrasted starkly with the brutal, bloody attrition of the Western Front. And it's really there that you see that the seed that becomes the flower of the Lawrence of Arabia myth growing. Now, of course, you know, if you do have family members fighting in that part of the world, it becomes very, very important. And I think, you know, for people living in Australia and New Zealand, those battle zones of the Ottoman Empire in the First World War are extremely important. Obviously, the Anzacs, as they were known, formed part of a multinational landing force in April 1915. And it was written about in, you know, euphoric terms by war correspondents like Ellis, Ashmead, Bartlett and Charles Bean, who, you know, within weeks were describing the Gallipoli landings as the birth of the Australian nation. You know, and that's as much a myth as the Lawrence of Arabia myth, but it goes to the heart of a very sort of crude Australian nationalism that depicts itself in contrast to Britain.
Thank you. Hussein Omar, how did the conflict in the Ottoman Empire end, or not end, in 1918?
So I think, as people have argued for Central and Eastern Europe, the war doesn't really end in 1918 is really the starting point of these extraordinary anti-colonial movements that break out across the region. So in Libya, in Egypt, in Iraq, in Tunisia, in Palestine, in Syria, in Sudan, in Somaliland. And these are all movements that are popular movements, much more popular than the Arab Revolt itself, but which aren't as remembered quite so vividly. And I think part of the reason they're not remembered so vividly is that there isn't a kind of white savior granting these peoples a kind of freedom as you have in the case of Lawrence, right? So these are actually, in effect, much more important in terms of outcomes. They produce sovereign states in Egypt, Iraq, Syria, etc., unlike the Arab Kingdom, which it lasted for a very short time, but they're not. We don't talk about them quite as much. But they, you know, they go on right into the 1930s.
Neil Faulkner, how did Lawrence react to the way this was resolved? He went to conferences in up to 1922, didn't he? What was he saying at those conferences, and how was his voice heard?
He's at two particularly important conferences. He's an advisor to Faisal at Versailles in 1919. And then again, he's an advisor to Churchill when Churchill was colonial secretary in Cairo in 1921. And I think what Lawrence is doing is he's operating in post-war diplomacy in an attempt to get what he considers to be the best possible outcome for the Arabs. Now, I don't think that he had a clear conception of what that would look like. And just to pick up the point that Hussein has just made, I mean, I've already described him as a liberal imperialist, and I think his conception was that the, as he saw it, the more benevolent British Empire would provide the framework for the growing to nationhood of these new Arab states. And yet, of course, in reality, there was a wave of revolt from below where ordinary people were beginning to create their own future. And those attempts were, generally speaking, suppressed by the British Empire, with which Lawrence is closely associated in this post-war diplomacy. So it's quite a limited view, I think, that he has of what might happen.
There's a famous 1918 map where Lawrence sort of lays out his vision of what the region would look like. And it involves a Kurdish state, an Armenian state, an Arab state. But this is, I mean, to realise that kind of map would have involved what we now would call ethnic cleansing, right? Because it would necessarily call for the removal of populations into single ethnic states, which of course the Middle East could never be, because all of these regions were multi-religious, multilingual, multi-ethnic.
Quite early on, really, just a few years, two or three years after the war, Lawrence began his global fame, down to an American reporter and cinematographer who made a report on him, showed it in Broadway, then in London, and we told hundreds of thousands, million people saw it, and they wanted more of Lawrence, not of Allenby walking with his army in, and he grew from there. Can you take that on?
Yes. I mean, he wasn't a famous man at the end of the First World War. He becomes a famous man because of the Lowell Thomas show in 1919, which changes, actually. It evolves. I mean, initially, there wasn't that much emphasis on Lawrence because he...
Can you tell listeners what the Lowell Thomas show was?
Because it's rather it was a weird kind of thing, and we don't do this kind of thing anymore. But it was a sort of... It was described as a travelogue. And I understand that it consisted of a series of what were then called lantern slides, old-fashioned slides, some moving images, a certain amount of music, some dancing, and a very racy commentary on the part of Lowell Thomas himself, the American journalist who becomes a kind of impresario. Now, what seems to happen as the show evolves is that the Lawrence element is ramped up because audiences respond with more enthusiasm to the Lawrence character than they do to the General Allenby and the traditional British military operations. And that turns Lawrence into what he himself describes as a matinee idol. He becomes an early example of 20th century celebrity culture.
And then he moves away into this strange... 13, 15 years of being in the ranks in the RAF, in the tank regiment, back in the RAF, and one of you described as a slow mental breakdown. Seven Pillars of Wisdom came out. His, some people think, great book. You think great book. And very accurate recording of reporting on what was happening there. Is there anything more that anybody wants to say about those last years? Has he abandoned the Arab cause? Has that abandoned him? Where are we?
Well, what I would say is that he's abandoned the attempt to make a difference in 1921-22 because he's got as far as he thinks he can with the Cairo conference. And I think at the same time as he's involved in that post-war diplomatic effort, he's suffering a kind of mental breakdown. And I think you can read that in the pages of Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And I see him as a kind of permanent convalescent after that.
Is he breakdown because the British have betrayed the Arabs?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there are many different factors. We now talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, but that's a kind of portmanteau term anyway. It covers many different things. But I think specifically in his case, he was riddled with guilt about what he saw as the betrayal of the Arabs by British and French imperialism.
Hussein, what happened to the idea of an Arab kingdom?
Sharif Hussein declares himself caliph when the Ottoman Empire is formally abolished and the caliphate is formally abolished in 1924. But the But by that point, he's already been abandoned by his British allies, who allow their other allies, the Ibn Sa'uds, to enter into Mecca and Medina and wrest it from the hands of Sharif Hussein, who dies in the early 30s in Transjordan, the newly established state of Transjordan, where his son Abdullah is now king. So it's a very sad story. But that's not really the end of the kind of dream of a united Arab kingdom. That lives on right into the 1960s with the establishment of the United Arab Republic under Nasser, which unites Egypt and Syria and attempts to unite more and more states. What's interesting is that the British conceive of the Arab kingdom as being primarily a religious entity. They understand it as a counterweight to the idea of the caliphate. But the appeal of the Arab kingdom to many Arabs, or to the Arab Republic subsequently, is precisely the opposite, that it's a secular republic that allows them to escape the caliphate as an institution. And that's why many non-Muslims become very early adherents to the idea of the Arab kingdom and continue to be very important within the ranks of Arab nationalism right into the 60s.
Katrina, panel, do you think that the way that the land was divided up, lines drawn across a map, became an obstruction to unities which persists?
I think it's quite simplistic to just look at where borders are drawn and to extrapolate from there, or you know, a century's worth of problems. I think it's worth bearing in mind that there are several different iterations of the perceived future of the Arab lands of the Ottoman Empire as the war is unfolding. Neil's already mentioned the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which is often held up as, you know, the straw man of everything that is wrong with the Middle East today. And I think we have to be really careful there, because Sykes-Picot Agreement was drawn up but 2 years before the end of the war, and many things changed from that agreement to the final settlement, not least the fact that in Sykes-Picot, France was originally going to have significant portions of Iraq that then ended up under British control. And also, as we've mentioned already, Russia was part of Sykes-Picot and then drops out of the war and thus out of that agreement. I think it's worth bearing in mind that, you know, all defeated parties in the First World War are subjected to some kind of reorganisation and dismemberment. The Ottoman Empire is not unique in that sense. What is interesting about the peace process in the Ottoman Empire is what a protracted affair it is. You know, it starts in 1919, but it doesn't end until 1923 with the Treaty of Lausanne. On the whole, the European powers, I think, are able to draw the lines that most meet their interest and advantage, but there are moments where there is resistance to that. The 1920 Treaty of Sèvres is resisted by a Turkish nationalist movement led by Mustafa Kemal, who was obviously a key officer at Gallipoli, at Kanakale, who is then able to expand the original Anatolian heartland that's outlined in the Treaty of Sèvres to the eventual Turkish Republic that we know today, that was defined in the Treaty of Lausanne. But the Europeans, I think, on the most part in the Arab lands, were able to draw the lines where they wanted them to be.
Briefly,
we should be careful about the lines drawn in the sand, because this often allows to talk about the Middle East as being made up of uniquely artificial states. And the idea of the artificial state has often been used to justify a lot of violence and repression within those states. So the RAF bombings in Iraq, etc. Faisal himself, when he becomes king of Iraq, talks about the Iraqi people needing to be made, but claiming that they're an artificial entity. But that's a political statement that allows a certain specific kind of government within those states, which is often very violent and repressive.
Mm. And I would also add to that, you know, it's not necessarily where the lines that are drawn that necessarily causes the problems. It's how those states are then managed, you know, both by the British and the French, the divide and rule tactics, the colonial oppression, the violence, the manipulation of particular minority groups that are preferenced over others. So I think to reduce it all down to lines is overly simplistic.
Finally, Neil, we all know about, well, I suppose we all know about Lawrence of Arabia and Peter O'Toole, the revival of the global myth, if you want, legend, if you want, of Lawrence of Arabia. Do you think that had any truth in it, as far as you're concerned, as a military historian?
Well, I mean, what I would say about the movie is, as a piece of cinema, it is magnificent. It's also of its time. It's riddled with sort of Orientalist stereotypes. Does it tell an essential truth about Lawrence? I think it does. I think it's when I watch the film, it's almost like a Greek tragedy playing out, where this hero goes into an exotic location to do deeds of derring do, full of idealism and enthusiasm, and is slowly destroyed by the contradictions of war and wartime diplomacy and the betrayal of the people that he is fighting with. And in that sense, it works for me as a piece of drama in the old-fashioned Greek manner. So I think the film is great. Does it help us to understand the modern Middle East? No, not really.
Well, you can't say better than that for the end of the programme. Thank you very much. Thank you, Katrina Pennell, Hussein Omar and Neil Faulkner. Next week, it's the history of coffee, from its origins in Ethiopia to the coffee houses of the 18th century and its link to slavery as it became a global commodity. Thank you very much for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
I think for me, what I find hard is that I've worked so hard to move away from just focusing on Lawrence. You know, my sort of early introduction to this history in this part of the world from as a British schoolchild was through those ideas of Lawrence of Arabia. And I feel like I've made a concerted effort to not understand that history through the prism of one white man. So, yeah, for me, that's really important.
Why did you not want... I mean, I can understand why you didn't want, but will you tell listeners why you didn't want to...
Because for me, it is everything that's problematic about the way that British people tell themselves stories about British imperial history. And it's, I mean, I think you used the term white colonial saviour. It's a rather romantic idea. It's this idea of chivalry, this idea of the mysterious East, which is just hugely, hugely problematic. Yes. And... you know, I think we have a duty to tell a much more complex and varied and multi-perspective story than just the experience of one white man.
I agree, but it isn't forbidden to tell the story of one person, is it?
I'm not saying it's forbidden, but for me, I find it more interesting to hear the stories of other people.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's worth doing in order to dismantle, right? I mean, because it's obviously speaking to a concern that people have, and so we should build on that concern to ask different sorts of questions and to redirect the way in which we think about this figure. From my perspective, he simply doesn't loom very largely in the Arab imaginary or in the Arabophone imaginary.
But is that because he doesn't or because they don't want him to?
No, I think it's just because he doesn't, because actually the much more momentous events are happening outside the Arab Revolt. The Arab Revolt is very important, but also, I mean, the film is quite important. I mean, the later film is quite important, but it's seen as a kind of as something kind of exotic and distancing. It's not people don't watch it and see themselves in it. In Egypt, it's important because Omar Sharif is in it, and you know he is Egypt's greatest celebrity, and so that kind of has a different meaning. But it's not that people see themselves in the story when it's told in that way. And it's not. I don't think it's a question of denial. It's just that the more momentous events are happening elsewhere.
Yeah, no, I go with that completely. I go with what both Katrina and Hussein are saying. And it seems to me that we need to separate out two things, which is that there is a cultural phenomenon, and it is the Lawrence of Arabia legend, and it's constantly evolving. And one investigates that with one set of, if you like, academic spectacles on. And there's a whole other issue which one examines with a different set of academic spectacles, which is the history of the Middle East since the time of the First World War. And the connection between the two is a very, very limited one. And I think probably the former, the legend, has not contributed to a high level of popular understanding of what's really gone on in the Middle East over the last century. So it's not terribly helpful in that sense. And we should separate out those two things, the cultural phenomenon and the real history of the Middle East.
You can say that, though, about, I think, a number of cultural outputs that have come from the First World War. I'm thinking of Peter Weir's 1981 Gallipoli.
Yes.
Just going back to the earlier point about, you know, the Anzac legend and the idea of Australian birth on the battlefields of Kanakali, Gallipoli. But it is interesting the way cinema in particular, as well as novels and fiction, has contributed to certain ideas being implanted in the public imaginary that have retained such pertinence and such strength, even when there are, you know, vast numbers of very interesting scholarly books that challenge some of the ideas within them.
Why do you think that is, though? That's what's interesting as well, isn't it? It's interesting that they have such a standing strength. Mm. I mean, let's agree with everything you say. It isn't accurate. It didn't happen like that. It wasn't very significant, as you say. Orange wasn't in the greater scheme of things. But why has it got such... Is it just to do with the Brits wanting their own heroes and thinking, well, not just the British, is it? It's all over the place.
I mean, I think at the heart of it is actually the claim that freedom in the colonial world comes from the colonizers, right? So that's something that people like to hear.
It's a comfortable
and there's
story.
There's a version of it that gets told with Woodrow Wilson, right? Yeah. That the anti-colonial movements that happen in Egypt, Iraq, etc., are inspired by Wilson's words in the same way. And so those together have been very persistent, because then freedom is a gift to the colonized. Mm.
But I'm sorry.
This is the white man on the white horse riding in and saving the natives.
Yeah. And Hussein's work on those popular movements that were there in the Middle East in the sort of, you know, the end of the First World War into the early 1920s, that is actually for most of the kind of general popular audience in the English-speaking world, that's hidden history. That's a history of Middle Eastern people, people in the region actually creating their own history rather than having it imposed upon them by people coming in from the outside.
Mm. And as well, these cultural ideas often have sustaining power for as long as they serve a particular purpose, you know, and I think in the case of the Lawrence myth, it's serving a particular purpose that makes colonial history palatable. It makes it comfortable. It makes it relatively easy to understand. I think in the case of Peter Weir's Gallipoli, it's serving a particular purpose about Australian conservative politics and relationship to the military that still has a sustaining power to this day.
Mm. Is there no way in which, I mean, I'm interested in the individual against the rest, as it were. There's no way to balance it, is there?
I think there is. I think, you know, there are some fantastic examples of historical biography that allow the individual to be used as a prism through which more complex ideas and structures in this context about empire can be understood.
Yeah.
I think if we just obsess around the individual, though, without that additional context, that's when it becomes very reductive and limited.
Mm. And it might be worth saying as well, I mean, it occurs to me that Lawrence is able to play quite a significant role in the revolt for the reasons that I've indicated, in a way that would not have been true in relation to any genuinely popular mass movement. Why is he able to play that role? He's able to play that role because this is a very reactionary social group, actually. These are tribal leaders from Arabia. They are not progressive in any sense at all. They are not the same as the middle-class nationalists in Damascus and Beirut and places like that. I mean, if Lawrence had been inserted into a real popular movement for self-emancipation, he couldn't have played the role that he does. So he's anomalous, partly because he is this weird romantic who identifies with a certain type of Arab, or what he imagines a certain type of Arab to be like.
I think that's right. I mean, I'm a little bit more cautious about sort of saying some movements are more real than others, but it's certainly of a kind of scale that makes it possible for him to participate in that way. If you think about the hundreds of thousands of people that take to the streets in Egypt or Iraq within a few years of that, it's simply not a movement that can be controlled by any one individual. It doesn't have any top-down... I mean, there is no leadership. These are leaderless popular movements. And I think perhaps I wouldn't say necessarily that this one is reactionary, but it's definitely a movement with a leader and with a leadership. And it's a planned movement, whereas these other uprisings, which are much, much larger, are quite spontaneous, actually.
Well, thank you all very much indeed.
Thank you.
Here's the man.
Does anyone want tea or coffee? Coffee?
Cup of tea, please.
Tea. Cup of tea would be
tea,
very
please.
Nice.
Coffee, please.
Nothing?
If we're doing coffee next week, I'd better start now.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.